couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about A Wrinkle in Time, Gringo, Strangers, Pray at Night, and The Hurricane Heist. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Thor Ragnarok and Aliens Ate My Homework. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's start off the news with a rest in peace to David Ogden Stiers. He died last Saturday, March 3rd, of bladder cancer at age 75. He's best known for playing the character of Winchester on MASH, which I loved MASH when I was a kid growing up. I was watching a lot of it on reruns. And I do remember when it ended and how emotional that was. It was such a big event in television. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting about MASH as a series is with both the characters of Trapper John going to BJ Honeycutt and Frank going to Winchester, even when you had McLean Stevenson get replaced with Harry Morgan, these all seem to be improvements on the story, where the original concept was drawing off the movie, the TV show became its own thing. And so you had these characters all improved upon the characters because they fit more in line with what the show was doing. And so I thought David Ogden Stiers was fantastic in that. And then he continued to have a name for himself and had voiceover work, and he did other TV shows. I remember he was in the Stargate Atlantis series, which I really enjoyed. He developed into such a authentically warm and but at times could be very stuffy actor, and he was perfect in so many roles. So it's sad to see him go. Next thing I would need to do is I need to issue a correction. I had mistakenly said in the discussion of who was going to win best director last week, I had a listener who on Twitter pointed out I had said that Guillermo del Toro was from Puerto Rico. I don't know why I said that. My brain wasn't working. I mean, I know he's from Mexico. I'd seen some of his Mexican movies like Cronus before he ever became famous. So, yeah, he's Mexican. He's not Puerto Rican. My apologies for that. We all heard him talk about the fact he's Mexican on Sunday night. And, of course, this is like the third out of fourth Mexican to have won Best Directing Oscar in the last, what, 5-6 years, something like that. So it's kind of an interesting element that Mexicans are dominating the best director category at the Oscars, which is, you know, who thought of that? Speaking of the Oscars, let's talk just really quick. You know, it's the ratings were down. And of course, even like the president is tweeting about this, which really could. I think the president has bigger stuff to worry about than worrying about the Oscars. Yeah, did they throw some digs at him? Sure. But, you know, overall, actually, I thought that it wasn't terribly political in terms of irrelevant stuff. There were political parts to it. There were political jabs at the administration by Jimmy Kimmel, but that's sort of in the late night context line. I mean, these were not, first of all, these weren't like unfair things. These were just jokes that you would normally see on a monologue. And when you had people talking about politics, surely they addressed it, but it was like immigrants talking about immigration issues, you know, Lupita Nyong'o and Guillermo del Toro. Those are certainly relevant to their careers, or people talking about the Me Too movement or something like that, which is certainly relevant considering that was a seismic charge that was let off with Harvey Weinstein back in, what, October. And this is the industry saying, look, we're taking charge of this and we're doing something in our own industry that we want to fix. And even when you go into the whole thing where Frances McDormand gave her speech and talked about inclusion writers, which I'll talk about that later, what that actually means, these are relevant to the movies. This is not irrelevant stuff that's just, hey, this is my pet issue I'm throwing out there. But the Oscar ratings aren't down. It's not because of politics, even though that's a narrative a lot of people want to spin. I mean, the Oscars have always been political. You have to go back years and years. I don't even know if you could find an Oscars production that didn't have a certain degree of politics to it. Also, it's not the box office. I know that's another narrative people like to spin. I mean, yeah, when you have a movie like Titanic and everyone's seen it, it can boost the numbers, but Do we really want the Oscars to be about box office? Do we really want the Oscars to pick the best grossing movie of the year? If you did that, then, you know, Transformers 2 would have been up for Best Picture, and I don't think anybody wants that nonsense. I think the reason that the Oscars had such low ratings is we're past the moment of the four-hour ceremony. You're literally asking people to carve out 4 hours of their time on a Sunday night, sometimes on like on the East Coast, to stay up almost to midnight. And if you need to go to work the next day, this isn't the Super Bowl. And this isn't like the Super Bowl, which unfolds in real time. This could be distilled down to an hour to an hour and a half ceremony. You know, back in the day when the Oscars would air in the 70s and 80s, I remember growing up watching it, you had no other options. You basically had three stations and PBS, unless you were lucky enough to have cable. And cable really didn't explode into the market until the late 80s and early 90s. So back then, you didn't have a whole lot of options. Now, there's so many other options, just in terms of leisure options, which even you can do in the cold weather inside. It used to be they put it on there in the winter because people weren't out doing stuff that late. But you got cable TV, you got DVR recordings, you've got on-demand and streaming, DVD and Blu-ray. That's all just stuff if you want to watch. Plus the entirety of the internet and mobile apps and games. This is all stuff you can do on a Sunday night, on your couch, in your jammies. You don't have to watch the Oscars. That's why people aren't watching. It's because it's a four-hour ceremony and you can just update it online. You can get reports online. They should make it a one-hour ceremony, put like Ricky Gervais in charge of the monologue and not check what he's going to do. And let it be a, oh my God, what's going to happen? Now, Hollywood's not going to do that until the numbers dip below 20, but we'll see. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Book Club, which opens on May 18th.
Hi, beautiful friends.
I would like to introduce you to Christian Grey.
Oh, no.
We started this book club to stimulate our minds.
From what I hear, this book is quite stimulating.
Have you ever been spanked?
What?
This book has got me in a total tizzy.
Give me the zip ties.
Are you thinking about tying me up?
What?
If women our age were meant to have sex, God wouldn't do what he does to our bodies.
Speak for yourself.
Well, that was not God. That was Dr. Nazarian.
This looks like another one of those typical old people having sex movies, which I find these kind of sweet sometimes. I mean, we had that one just this past Christmas about the old folks home with Morgan Freeman and Tommy Lee Jones. It wasn't great. But I think these are kind of fun. I like watching these movies now. I mean, I'm still relatively young. I'm in my mid-40s. But I think it's neat that they have these movies for an older generation. It reminds me of the movie Hope Springs, which was the one with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones going to a sex therapy weekend. I think it's relying too much on 50 Shades of Grey because that thing's a horrible book. And actually, these comedians, you know, Candace Bergen, it's kind of cool to see her again. And you know, Mary Steenburgen looks like she's going to carry her own. Even Jane Fonda looks like she's appropriately cast in this movie. The next one I want to talk about is Christopher Robin, which opens on August 3rd.
We've called an emergency meeting this weekend. I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend, sir.
We need to cut 20%.
You promised these people good jobs.
I thought you'd do anything for this company.
What to do indeed.
Pooh?
Christopher Robin.
Do not mistake this for Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which was this overly morose, heavy movie by, I think, Fox Searchlight or someone else from last year. No, this is sort of like the Hook version of Christopher Robin, where if Christopher Robin grew up and suddenly he starts seeing Winnie the Pooh again. This looks like it could be sweet. This is Disney mining their own movies like the Mary Poppins sequel that's going to be coming out at Christmas as well. So this one could be cute. I mean, it's an August movie, so I wouldn't expect too much from it, but it looks kind of charming. And that is it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Strangers, Pray at Night, and the Hurricane Heist. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start right into the movie reviews with Strangers Prey at Night. Three masked killers torment the dumbest family in the world who likes to trip a lot and drop things on a vacation in a deserted trailer park.
This place seems empty.
I think everybody leaves after Labor Day.
This is nice, right?
There's someone else staying here?
Is Tamara home?
I think you have the wrong trailer.
I thought we were all alone.
Leave us alone!
But we've just started.
This is a sequel to the original The Strangers, which came out 10 years ago, believe it or not, back in 2008. And that was a grisly horror movie. And it kind of was a bit of a surprise when this came out, because it was kind of this surprise hit. And both of these movies say, oh, hey, this is based on a real incident. And it's arguably kind of like the inspiration, the original incident. I've read up a little bit of it, and it was part of it's also about the Manson family murders inspired some of this, but it's also there was this Keddie Cabin murders back in 1981 where there are these grisly murders that happened that were never solved. And I don't know. It always makes me a little uncomfortable to have an exploitation film about a real life event. I mean, you can talk about Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Psycho being inspired by Ed Gein, kind of. I mean, they really kind of created their own thing. But the idea of just this home invasion, it was effectively done. In the original movie, The Strangers, I was not a huge fan because I felt it was just a little bit of misery porn. But it was effectively done in terms of the scariness of a home invasion. But the home invasion genre sort of deteriorated a bit over the years. And I thought that it sort of put a cap on it with a movie like You're Next, which completely deconstructed it. So this one, it just seems odd that they're making a sequel 10 years later. The first one came out in 2008. This one doesn't really offer anything new. And that's the big problem with it, is you'd expect them to say, oh, let's have something different happen with the characters, and let's go a little bit more into detail. And while they give a certain, there's a little bit of some reveals going on in the film, it is just them hunting down this family. And part of the key to having a good horror movie, you got to go one of two ways. You can go campy, like the Friday the 13th movies, which were just slasher sort of machete fodder back in the day, where you have sympathy for the characters because you're just like, oh, they're people getting attacked by a killer. But there's not a whole lot of humanity infused into a film like that. That's sort of what a slasher movie is. This is trying to take the humanity of watching this happen, but then it gets really grisly and uncomfortable. If you just know these people are going to get killed, why do you want to see the movie? And there's scenes in this movie, though, where they set up the family as being kind of dysfunctional. They're sending the teenage daughter off to boarding school for some thing she had done, which they don't explain. And so there's a lot of tension with the family, the parents and the kids, which they never resolve. But of course, when the strangers start coming after them, they kind of band together and try and survive. But they just do some of the dumbest things. I mean, every time they get a weapon in their hand, they either drop it or lose it. And when they have the chance of the upper hand, they just wuss out. There's literally a scene where somebody has a gun to one of the bad guys, and you know it's them. It's not somebody that could be just dressed in a mask. It's definitely the bad guy. And there's people in the audience who are going, God, just shoot her. Shoot, shoot. And it's, you know, a movie like The Hills Have Eyes, both that the original and the remake, they have this little thing where the sort of like the meek family gets attacked and they spin around and are able to defend themselves to a certain degree. That's sort of what The Hills Have Eyes is about. And that's kind of interesting to watch. And we saw that play out to the nth degree in You're Next. But this one just kind of violence for the sake of just watching cruelty. And I don't get into that. So I'm going to have to say Strangers Prey at Night kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the hurricane heist. A group of armed men descend upon a U.S. Treasury facility in Alabama in hopes of stealing the money during a massive hurricane.
There's a hurricane coming.
Agent Corbin reporting in.
600 million. Bob Lovett?
It's all here with about 300 million of its cousins.
It's your responsibility.
I'm all right at babysitting old money. This is not good.
No witnesses.
The treasury's being robbed.
Where is she?
They need me. I'm the only one with the code.
We're about to be crushed by the biggest storm of the century.
First of all, with this movie, it's just a stupid action movie. It's directed by Rob Cohen. He did the original Fast and Furious. I mean, the first one, like 20 years ago. And he did the original Triple X, again, about 20 years ago. He didn't do any of the sequels that suddenly became much more popular for Vin Diesel. This is just a throwaway action movie. It's something you would have seen made in the 90s. It reminds me a bit of Hard Rain, which was that movie with Christian Slater and Morgan Freeman. And it was a similar story where there, these people were using the natural disaster of a massive flood to cover some heist they were doing. I don't even remember what the heist was. This was at the time when they were sort of like bringing back nature thriller movies like Dante's Peak and Volcano. Only this had more than just survive the storm. It was, they're trying to stop a heist. You know, there's a certain part of this that I actually enjoyed. I mean, I enjoyed it for just the stupidness of it. I enjoyed it for just the throwaway garbage movie. This is the kind of thing you're going to see on Riff Tracks in probably about 5 years. They'll do a riff on this and it would be brilliant. It's like Roadhouse, but without the brilliant acting that goes along with it. But what's funny about this movie is all the stuff that's surrounded it, it's getting weird advertising. Some people have seen a lot of advertising for it, like on ESPN, but other people haven't seen it anywhere. I didn't even know this movie existed. I didn't even know what it was. Hadn't seen a poster until like a week ago. And then I went to go see the movie because they didn't screen it for anybody. I went to go see the movie on Thursday night and I step up to the box office and I say one for Hurricane Heist. And the girl who's working the box office just kind of looks at me with this glassy look over her eyes and she's like, oh, I didn't even know we were showing that movie. And I'm like, well, that's not a good sign. So I buy my ticket and I go down to the theater, which was this relatively small theater in a 24 screen cinema. And it's completely empty. Nobody's in this movie at all. And this has only happened a couple times. Usually if there's a screening like on a Thursday night, it is rare to be the only person in that theater. But I think it's maybe happened 5 times in my entire career. And this is one of them. Another one was like Victor Frankenstein. So I go in and I watch the movie and I tweet about it because I said, oh, look, an empty theater. And I put it, and somebody says, is this even a real movie? I go, well, there were pictures on the screen for an hour and 40 minutes. Jury's still out on whether or not it's a real movie. The bottom line is it's dumb. The characters are terrible. And unfortunately, you got somebody like Tony Kebbell, who's a really good actor, who's playing in it. And he's does what he can with it. Maggie Grace is sort of slumming it now after she kind of bounced up there with Lost and Taken about 10, 15 years ago. Now she's relegated to doing movies like this. Her level of this movie is reminds me of her doing that movie, I think it was called Lockout, with Guy Pearce in this space prison. That's the level of movie we get with this. So this is totally a checking your brain at the door. There's a certain enjoyability to its garbageness, but I'm going to have to still say that the Hurricane Heist kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about A Wrinkle in Time and Gringo. Two Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with A Wrinkle in Time. In this adaptation of Madeleine L'Engle's classic book, a group of children find themselves traveling across space and time to try to rescue one of their fathers.
You were a top student, but look at you now. You can't keep using your father's disappearance as an excuse to act out.
We heard a cry out in the universe.
My father's alive.
We believe he is. And we're here to help you find them.
We are in search of warriors.
Warriors who serve the good and the light in the universe.
Your father's trapped by evil energy. And the only one who can stop it is you.
It's been decades since I've read this book. I don't even remember how I was like in second or third grade, maybe, when I read it. I mean, it's a classic book. I think it was written originally in 1962. And I would have read it in the late 70s, maybe the early 80s, but I think it was in the late 70s. And it always has stuck with me. And it's a neat story. And I forgot until I saw the movie and I was going back and kind of looking at the synopsis of the book. It escaped me how kind of out there it was. And I mean, Madeline L'Engle was a famous science fiction writer, and she wrote, you know, grown-up books as well as children's books. And she also wrote contemporary stuff as well, you know, just sort of regular dramas. But she was a well-known, along with maybe Ursula Le Guin back in the 60s to 70s, I would put them as kind of comparable in terms of notoriety and fame. And, you know, The Wrinkle in Time has had a rough time trying to make it to the screen. I know they did a TV movie adaptation of it back when L'Engle was still alive, and she had a famous quote where she said, "It lived up to my expectations. I expected it to be terrible, and it was," which I always thought was really kind of a fun line from her. I've never seen that adaptation. This one is part of what makes this significant. It is somewhat historic because Ava DuVernay, who did Selma and 13th, is the director of this, and she is the first African-American woman to be given a directing gig with a budget of $100 million or more, which is significant. And what's interesting is, if I recall correctly, she was originally going to do Black Panther, and she exited that project and ended up taking on this one, all still under the umbrella of Disney. And it was probably a good thing because, you know, Black Panther, I think Ryan Coogler hit exactly what he needed to do. That movie became exactly what it needed to be. Wrinkle in Time, I don't think you can say that. It's not exactly what it needed to be. In one sense, I think her going from biopics and documentaries all the way to this really out-of-the-box sort of mystical fantasy, that was a huge leap for her. And I think that Ava struggles with that a bit in terms of adapting this movie. There's also some problems in the script. And a lot of these come from the fact that it's a hard book to boil down. And it's a hard book to distill. And I think it's going to lose people, especially parents, in the sort of the explanation of what's going on. Kids in their mindset of children, they accept things and they'll be like, "Oh, okay, so they're traveling through time through these wrinkles in space. All right." It's the parents that are going to resist that in their heads. So I think it has some plot moments, it has some explanation moments, has some character moments that don't quite work. The cast, the girl who plays the main character, she's good. The kid who plays her brother, and that's a tough role because he's sort of like this child prodigy. Yeah, he's good and bad. It just doesn't quite click. And then there's the third kid who travels with them is almost marginalized so much it's insulting. It's almost like, why is he even there aside from the fact that he had a role? He had a role in the book and they brought him along. I don't know why. So there is some things that just don't quite make the transition. On one hand, it looks gorgeous. And I'm not just saying that because I like pretty pictures on the movie screen. I think it's important that we have different looks for fantasy movies. Ever since Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings came out, 20 years ago, those kind of movies almost back to back, every movie has looked like that. And even going back to fantasy movies, if you want to talk about sword and sorcery, sword and sandal fantasy movies, those have always had this sort of bleak, heavy look to them. And so when they started having all the effects, digital effects, everything is very gray and dark and ugly at times. And I think that what they do, they make this movie very lavish, and it's very interesting to look at. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, and I'll talk about, of course, this Blu-ray later, Thor Ragnarok. Thor Ragnarok did not look like a typical superhero movie, and I think that bodes well for that. It opens it up. Not everything has to look like Man of Steel or the Batman movie. And in the same way, not every movie needs to look like the sort of muted color of Mordor in Lord of the Rings. This movie has an open palette. I think that looks great. There's also some great messaging in there that with the kids and family issues. They do downplay the sort of like the overt Christian messaging that's in the book. I mean, to the point where they're quoting Bible verses in the book. This one, they scoot around that, but they don't like, I think they just say, well, you know, we're not going to make this that kind of movie. And they just scoot around some of that mentioning. But, you know, it is a real mixed bag. And I mean, on one hand, there's parts of it I really enjoyed. And then there's other parts that I really found myself rolling my eyes at. So I'm still going to say it kind of rocks just because it's worth seeing. And also mainly because I took my 8-year-old and he loved it. And with the exception of one kid that had to be brought out because she was bawling during a rather intense scene, which does kind of make me fondly remember movies like when they did like Something Wicked This Way Comes, which was from Disney, which is a dark movie. I mean, sort of subject matter dark. And it was this, you know, really kind of creepy movie back in the 80s. So it does kind of have these elements to it. So I wouldn't take the youngest kid because, like I said, one of the kids in the screening had to be taken out in tears. But my son loved it, and all the other kids that I talked to have loved it. I'm ultimately going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Gringo. A businessman is sent to Mexico by a company that produces a medical marijuana pill, only to be kidnapped by a drug cartel.
You're in some deep water, Harold.
Damn cash pool.
No, I'm saying you're poor.
Tomorrow, you're going to fly to Mexico.
What?
We want you to hand deliver the weed pill formula to the lab.
What's going on?
I've been kidnapped! I am somewhere in Mexico with a gun to my head!
We sold a little product to the cartels, but when we cut them off, they got a little angry.
We gotta get them out really quickly.
I know a guy.
I've tracked down dictators, but I can find a guy in middle management.
What do they want?
They want 5 million
pesos?
Dollars!
Ironically, the same weekend that Ava DuVernay has her big movie coming out, David Oyelowo is in his own movie. So they're kind of in competition with us. He was, of course, played Martin Luther King in Selma. Gringo is a movie that I initially wanted to see. And I thought it looked like it could be kind of funny. But as I continued to like watch the trailers, I kind of can't escape the fact that it felt like just another weed movie. And look, I'm not a weed guy. I have never smoked pot. I have no desire to smoke pot, mainly because the last thing I need is more munchies. And I've always kind of poo-pooed this sort of recreational marijuana use and the need for the legalization of it, because most people I've ever seen who really are for the legalization of marijuana is not because they think it's going to help people with leukemia. It's that they want to toke up on the weekends. So I've never gotten into pot movies. And this does feel like it's going to be filled with it's just a different version of a pot thriller. Kind of the way, I guess American Ultra was, I think they're kind of going for that same feel. The problem with pot movies is the audience doesn't come out for them. It's tough to get them off the couch, which is why movies like that tend to do well on home video. Even though it looks like it has some funny moments to it, I'm just so tired of pot movies and I'm so tired of the glorification of marijuana. It's just not my bag. And I'd love to see Charlton Copley in this. I think it might be kind of funny, but it could also just suck tremendously hard. So I had to choose two movies to see in a double feature on Thursday night to catch up, and Gringo lost on this one. So it gets a preemptive suck because it wasn't screened.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Oscar recap, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Thor Ragnarok and Aliens Ate My Homework.
Shake that.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr for the final segment. Gear up for my big fat Oscar predictions, and let's talk about how right I was and what a genius I am. Actually, I'm going to like pull the veil back on my, you know, genius. You know, I'm the man behind the curtain right now. I'm the wonderful Wizard of Oz, the great and powerful. I was not necessarily a genius when it came to my Oscar predictions. I was just going with where the wind's blowing. All the predictions I made last week: Best Picture, Best Direction, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor and Actress. Those were all where the wind was blowing. Those were the odds-on favorites to win. And The Shape of Water getting both Best Director and Best Picture I thought was great. I thought it was interesting that we did split a lot. You know, Three Billboards got some of the acting awards, and Shape of Water got Best Picture and Best Director, and there are other technical awards that went on. There were no real surprises, I thought. I mean, Get Out won Best Screenplay, but that's usually where, I even think I said that flippantly last week. I said that's where, you know, it might win Best Screenplay. That's usually where a movie like that would win. And Call Me By Your Name won Best Screenplay for Adapted Screenplay. But, like, the Best Actor being Gary Oldman, Best Supporting Actress of being Allison Janney. Those were both gimmies. We all knew those were happening. And then Sam Rockwell and Frances McDormand winning for Three Billboards was no big surprise. If there was any big surprise about the Oscars this past weekend, it was that there were no big surprises at all in the Oscars this past weekend. I really think they should have just given it to Moonlight. Again, I think that Warren Beatty should have announced Moonlight, or he should have announced La La Land. But I do give them credit that they came out and were like, look, we really screwed up last year. And they made jokes about themselves. I give Warren Beatty and even Faye Dunaway credit for coming back. Because Faye Dunaway, I mean, Warren Beatty had a little bit of cojones out there last year because he stayed on stage. The second Faye Dunaway realized she made a mistake, you couldn't find her. She left the building faster than Elvis did. So, not a huge surprise for Oscars this year, and we'll be doing the same thing next year if there's no big surprises. But yeah, at least there was no big scandal. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office from last weekend. Of course, Black Panther won again. It's sort of getting boring. Black Panther won again. Could we stop doing so well? The thing is, I'm kind of glad I saw Black Panther before it did as well as it did, because I could see myself rolling my eyes going, this isn't that good. I mean, Black Panther's a good movie, but is it $500 million good? That's what happened with Beauty and the Beast last year. Last year, Beauty and the Beast did so well, I was rolling my eyes saying, why? It's not that great of, I mean, it wasn't, you know, and so when it did so well, I didn't even want to watch it again when it came out on Blu-ray. My wife wanted to watch it, and I go, well, you watch it when I'm not here, because I think if I watch it again after as much success that it has, I'm going to go really sour on it. Red Sparrow came pretty soft at about $17 million. But the budget was only $70 million, so it doesn't have that much to make up, and I think it will eventually become profitable. Death Wish kind of was soft, $13 million. That's not great, especially for, you know, a Bruce Willis movie. But I think that's where we that one's probably going to be profitable because the budget wasn't very big. But I think it was part of unfortunate timing and just not a very good adaptation. It missed the mark on a lot of things that made the first one special. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. First movie I want to talk about is Thor Ragnarok. When his banished sister, the goddess of death, returns to Asgard, the mighty Thor crash lands on a distant planet where he's put into a gladiator-style arena.
It's main event time. And now, I give you your
We know each other. He's a friend from work.
Oh, come on.
Rewatching Thor Ragnarok on Blu-ray, which looks gorgeous, by the way. Again, like I talked about with A Wrinkle in Time, it's nice to see something that just doesn't look like every other Thor. I will say that the three Thor movies all have a very different look to them, which is kudos to Marvel for allowing not just different directors, but different production designers to give you something different. And even with Thor Ragnarok, they have a featurette talking about how they used Jack Kirby, who was the artist who created a lot of these, the look, certainly, and helped create some of the characters. Jack Kirby's drawings, they really pay tribute to him and make it look as much like Kirby's work as possible, which is that's a risk to take, because if you go back and look at it, they're gorgeous drawings from the 60s, but they look very 60s. They look very old school comic book, which doesn't quite work with the standard production design we see now. But I thought that they did a great job bringing that to life and making it look vibrant and cool, kind of like in the universe. So you could believe that it was in the same universe as Guardians of the Galaxy. I had such fun with this movie. I hadn't seen it since it had come out back in November, and I fell in love with the movie again. I just think it's what it's done is we've had 10 years to establish the Marvel Cinematic Universe that we can have one-off stories that aren't necessarily about leading up to something huge. We're not where something's going to be massive and game-changing, where we can just have a fun one-off comic book story, which is what they do in the comic books all the time. And I think that when we go back and historically look at these movies, you're going to say Thor Ragnarok was a point of evolution for the series, just as much as The Avengers was, just as much as Guardians of the Galaxy was. The Blu-ray also has some really great features. You know, it has the basic stuff, the commentary and the behind-the-scenes featurettes. And the one of my favorite parts to this is they have another episode of, I think, Team Daryl. It was either on Doctor Strange on the Blu-ray or it might have been on the Captain America Civil War Blu-ray. You had this little sketch, basically, where Thor was rooming with this guy. And, well, of course, Thor left. And the new guy who's rooming with him is the Grandmaster. And it's really funny because it's that sort of tongue-in-cheek, whimsical Marvel thing that they do that's just fun to watch. And Jeff Goldblum, anytime you can get more of Jeff Goldblum, it's fantastic. So yeah, I'm going to have to say Thor Ragnarok, again, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The next one in the Home Cinema Roundup I want to spotlight is Aliens Ate My Homework. A middle schooler helps a group of tiny aliens who crash land into his room to save the Earth from destruction.
No!
Earth paper is surprisingly nutritious.
Aliens ate my homework. I have aliens in my room. They need my help.
There's intelligent life on this world after all.
Cool.
Begin Operation Cover-Up!
This is going to get messy.
Awesome!
I'm gonna smush you!
I feel the need for speed.
Ow!
How did you move so fast?
Lower! Power!
Warrior science tells us exactly what to do next.
Now, this movie is both available on DVD and Blu-ray. It's also on Netflix right now. So if you have the subscription, you can watch it without racing. You watch without leaving the house, which is what we want to do nowadays. That's what I want to do. And this is based on a series of books written for middle schoolers. You know, it sort of has that feel of an iCarly or Disney Channel type show where you have little aliens. You know, it doesn't all kind of fit together. It's not high art science fiction. It's not trying to be pragmatically realistic like A Wrinkle in Time is. It's also not trying to be whimsical and silly and over the top, but in a series the way that Thor Ragnarok is. It's kind of just a smaller, made for the readers of the book. This is not made for parents. And it reminds me a little bit of that movie Middle School, The Worst Years of Our Lives. Those kind of films where it does kind of show the struggles of being in school. And of course you got this kid who literally the aliens do eat his homework. And they have to stop an invasion. It's cute enough for, so if you're looking for a family movie night and your kids want to see something a little bit out of the box, but you don't want to see things heavy. The one thing I can say about this is it's not overly heavy. Although what's funny is I watched it with my son, my 9-year-old, after we came back from seeing A Wrinkle in Time. And he said, because in this movie, the kid's father disappears. And he says, you know, this is the second movie we've seen that has this general plot where the father disappears and it's having an impact on the kids, which, you know, it's an interesting companion piece. Very, very different though. So I'm going to have to say, you know, for just a stupid Saturday afternoon way to waste some time with your kids. Yeah. Aliens Ate My Homework kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
On Blu-ray and DVD, you also have a couple movies that you can catch up with from the Oscar list. You've got The Greatest Showman, Lady Bird, Wonder Wheel, The Man Who Invented Christmas, Novitiate, and The Breadwinner. All of these available on DVD and Blu-ray, some of them award films, some of them not, but kind of all worth seeing in their own right, except for maybe Wonder Wheel. That's kind of bad. That's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Love, Simon, and Tomb Raider. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.